An open letter to the Minister of Education and Early Childhood Development, Becky Duren, was sent on June 8th to discuss the immediate need for protection of 2S LGBTQIA+ youth in schools. In an interview with CKDU, Naya Sharitsky from the Nova Scotia College of Social Workers and Veronica Merrifield from the Cape Breton Transgender Network discussed their collaborative efforts in the writing of this open letter and the updates needed to ensure the rights of transgender and gender nonconforming students are being met.
So this letter emerged as a result of our hearing multiple concerns in many different levels. So the first point of concern occurred in April. I was participating in a consultation meeting with doctors, psychiatrists, social workers, psychologists, clinicians. It's an interprofessional advisory board that Dr. Susing facilitates across the province for anyone providing gender-affirming care. And so we gather monthly to learn, share best practices, and continue working on how to best support individuals who are needing gender-affirming care. And multiple providers shared their observations that their students were, the younger patients of theirs were experiencing harm at schools because their patients were saying that they weren't able to use bathrooms, that they were being bullied at school, that they were being deadnamed, that their pronouns were not being used properly, that there was a lack of appropriate implementation of the laws and policies around protecting queer or transgender kids. And so in conversation there, there was this recognition there were also a growing number of incidents where there was like a pride flag that was burned. There were just a number of different issues. And so we talked about the need for intersectional representation at decision-making tables. This is a larger issue, not just within the schools. I literally just finished a conversation, a community consultation on the upcoming health equity framework that is being developed and the recommendations being developed. And the same issue happens. There isn't an intersectional lens where people of lived experiences of the many different types of diversities are included in decision making and in the implementation of. So what, for example, we later learned is that gender inclusive bathrooms, for example, are being locked in some schools by well-meaning staff that are afraid that students are going to use it to go smoking or do something nefarious. And as a result of this decision, this policy implementation decision by some folks, students are experiencing harm, not able to access the bathroom, experiencing gender conforming pressures to force them to pick a binary gender option, not feeling safe to access these resources. And a little mistake like that can cause profound harm that leads doctors and psychiatrists to be hearing stories from patients and their families saying, my child is afraid to go to school as a result. My child is experiencing depression and anxiety. My child is involved in self-harm as a result of these decisions. It's a really easy fix, but it takes someone understanding the importance of gender-inclusive bathrooms, which frankly, unless someone is transgender or non-binary and has themselves experienced what it's like to be constantly gender policed and harassed every time you want to go to the bathroom, until someone's experienced that, there is no way to have that full lens. And that's the point of intersectional diversity. There needs to be someone with that lens at every single level of decision making. Even if we do have very good laws, every school has their own policy of implementation. So, for example, one or two schools might be doing phenomenally well, and everybody is all of the staff, everyone is off, is protecting kids, using the pronouns right. And other schools, there isn't that best process. And so that was the beginning of what led to the creation of the letter. Since then, we've heard from other schools, of other social workers, other clinicians who reached out when they learned that I was putting together this letter of advocacy and shared a variety of other stories. There were several stories around the Conseil Acadien Provincial and École Beaubassin in particular, where we heard from parents who were saying that there was actually efforts to stop the teaching of gender inclusive curriculum. There were efforts made to stop it for children under the age of 7. There were threats that were made to staff who protested and wanted to advocate. So this issue became much larger than the initial presenting issue. And the more we dug into it, the more we saw that there was a broad pattern of lack of consistency in the way laws and policies are managed, in large part because there isn't someone with that particular lens. So there might be, for example, someone who represents the ANS community or someone who represents the Mi'kmaq community at some decision-making tables. But unless there's someone with a transgender non-binary lens of lived experience, then there's going to be unconscious bias that happens simply because other people have not been part of that. And what really needs to happen is this more inclusive lens at every single level. We also became aware that there isn't, the minister has not yet convened, as I understand it, the kind of consultation process and decision-making process that needs to happen for there to be good oversight of the way all of the schools are working together. And then the diversity so that the Conseil Acadien can have its own process is also problematic. And so the when we created this letter, it was really exciting because there was such broad consensus, whether it's doctors, psychiatrists, endocrinologists, whether it's public health experts, whether it's social workers, whether it's psychologists, whether it's physical therapists, whether it's teachers, whether it's family members, community members, advocates, pretty much every single person shared our goal and recognized that protecting transgender and non-binary children is first priority. And so for me, that was the most heartening part of this, is realizing how broad the consensus is. And so we even had, for example, the Liberal Party and the NDP coming together to support our recommendations. And so I feel like hopefully the government can hear this letter and realize that they have broad support in an era where the protection of queer and transgender kids in the States is at risk. To see so many people gathering in unity to protect and advocate for is so encouraging and heartwarming that it makes me really glad that I live here and not in the States.
And in that letter, I know it spoke about that the guidelines for supporting transgender and gender nonconforming students hasn't been updated since 2014. What are some of the risks around that, especially since and why hasn't that been a priority since there's been so much change in like almost 10 years now?
So I really appreciate that. There has not been a good priority on addressing the needs of the 2S LGBTQIA plus community in general in Nova Scotia. We actually have the most gender diverse population proportionately across all of Canada. And yet we have like barely any funding for Pride Health. We have such a lack of focus on supporting queer and transgender individuals, be they children or adults. There isn't a broad systemic approach to that level of diversity and inclusion at any level. So it's not surprising to me at some level that queer children would be seen as an afterthought, because that is reflective of what I'd say is a general lack of focus on queer and transgender diversity more broadly, despite the fact that we have a numbers that ought to mean a larger investment in protecting the needs and supporting the needs of the community. Not to mention that from a just diversity perspective, the number of people who are moving to Nova Scotia, specifically because of gender diversity, is massive. And yet we are not investing in what could be a growth opportunity by creating the consistent resources and support. So there hasn't been an investment in updating these guidelines, because I think there hasn't been an appropriate investment in the community more broadly. And so it's reflective of that larger gap, which is reflective of the lack of understanding, the bias, and also the unique understanding of transgender non-binary individuals that cannot be lumped in with other gay individuals. It's a unique set of issues that impacts us. And so it's important to do that larger focus. Now, what is needing to happen? And it is my understanding that there is work that is starting to happen right now around updating those guidelines. But the guidelines are especially important because the conversion ban that went into effect very recently, and the Nova Scotia Legal Information Society did a phenomenal research project that gives all sorts of information about what is conversion therapy and how does it manifest. Those laws now state that there is direct and indirect conversion therapy practices that exist. And as a result, indirect conversion therapy, for example, is having nowhere to go to the bathroom. That would be an example of a conversion practice that could make it so difficult for a person to function, like going to school, when they don't feel like they are safe to access either the boys' bathroom or the girls' bathroom, that they feel they can't go to school. That is a form of conversion practice, because even if it's completely unintentional, what it does is it causes pressure on someone to be like, well, maybe it's too hard to live a life that is transgender, so I'm going to stay in the closet. As a result, I'm not going to be myself because I don't feel like it's safe. Or, for example, we heard reports of certain schools where, let's say that in gym class, the boys are going to play against the girls. And for transgender non-binary individuals, they're told to pick a side for the day. Well, picking a side for the day seems like something from maybe a cisgendered perspective that's like easy to do, because they don't know what it's like to try to struggle to be yourself in a queerphobic world. And so those little examples serve as conversionary practices in that they serve to discourage people who identify as queer, transgender, non-binary to be themselves. And that discouragement is a form of conversion practice, which is now illegal. So it is doubly important to be updating these guidelines now with a lens to seeing how the lack of full inclusion and support is actually unintentionally serving as a type of conversion therapy that is now illegal and banned. It's a practice. So it's conversion therapy practices. It's not just what we might think of, like, I need to do like cognitive behavioral therapy to unlearn my desire to be myself. It's much more complex than that, and it is something that needs to be understood by the government, because that is why there needs to be an investment, because otherwise they are going against this conversion ban.
Yeah, and what are some positive changes that schools can make to help gender nonconforming and transgender students feel welcome? Stuff like that.
So being queer and transgender is a unique identity that very few other minorities have, because a child who is queer, transgender, even though research shows that they have a very early understanding of who they are, they experience harm, they experience discrimination at home, in religious communities, in society, watching TV, movies. So many different levels that school is sometimes the only safe place for a child to be. And if we look from a psychological developmental perspective, being able to feel safe to do basic things like go to the bathroom can influence your desire to live. And there are so many kids who, because of the discrimination that they experience in overt and covert ways, do not feel safe to be themselves, begin to self-harm and have suicidal ideation. And their psychological development is profoundly impacted in a way that very few other minority identities are, because it is a level of alienation where if a person is alienated from their own body, and a person is alienated from their parents, from their family, from their religious community, from the broader community, there isn't that level of safety, which every single psychologist and therapist would agree is fundamental to the development of identity. So if you don't even have that basic fundamental identity, it can cause profound harm that is lasting. And so that is why it's so crucial early on to train all kids to understand this so that they can be supportive of one another in order to reduce and mitigate the harm that will happen, because queer kids are growing up in a society that is queer phobic, a society where there isn't funding for gender affirming care, where there's still reports of providers who discriminate against kids who are gender diverse. And so the need to protect kids from the level of psychological harm that comes from a lack of supportive environment is profound and pressing and urgent, because children's lives are at stake.
What's happening on July 31st? If you can explain a bit about that discussion panel that's going on.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. So on July 31st, we are going to be hosting a Big Ideas in Mental Health panel. And this is a series that we have been doing for the last couple of years at the Nova Scotia College of Social Workers. The idea of Big Ideas in Mental Health is this notion that mental health is not separate from physical health, from community health, from structural health. And so our Big Ideas in Mental Health panels that we have held on a number of different issues is part of our larger advocacy to integrate the psychosocial, spiritual, and structural components of health into healthcare. So for example, if I'm depressed and I also am dealing with homelessness, then having some cognitive behavioral therapy to address my anxiety and depression isn't going to help me if I can't afford to pay rent because I'm not able to get a job without experiencing discrimination. So there's a deeper need for understanding around how to fix our mental health care system and how to understand the connection between structural issues and psychosocial issues with mental health. That is a larger advocacy project that we have. And so we periodically have different panels highlighting different issues. For example, homelessness and mental health is one issue. So we are having one specifically around gender diversity, LGBTQIA plus children's mental health needs and what is needed in the school system. And we are hosting panels because we believe in the importance of multiple voices, each bringing a different lens to the larger solution. There should never be just one or two people who are part of this. So the vision is to always have experts from different disciplines coming together with people who have lived experience so that people who have lived experiences' voices are heard and included in the larger recommendation. So we are going to be having on July 31st psychiatrists, doctors, queer kids, therapists, community advocates, people with lived experience, all coming together to share their unique recommendations and perspectives on what needs to be done to protect 2SLGBTQIA plus children in the schools and in their psychological development. The letter that we wrote is just the beginning of a much larger process that needs to happen.
And next up, CKDU spoke with Veronica Merrifield from the Cape Breton Transgender Network. What exactly was your role in this, or the Cape Breton Transgender Network's role?
The Nova Scotia College of Social Workers reached out to me in part of the support round, knowing that I do a considerable amount of work with the Cape Breton transgender network with schools and school kids.
What are some of the main issues that you feel need to be addressed most from the letter?
Sure. So in the work that I do, I come across a lot of children and youth that have various issues at school and have had for a number of years. So particularly around things like coming out at school, when they live in hostile home environments where they need to be able to be themselves. Living in a hostile home environment is a fairly high contributor to mental health issues such as depression, and leads to suicides. In the years that I've been living here in Cape Breton, there have been a number of suicides from the youth, often surrounding the bullying that they get at school, even if they have a supportive home environments. And yet other schools seem to be doing fairly well. And, you know, the children, youth and parents that I get to talk to from some of those talk about some of those good experiences. So the there's a gap in how these kind of policies that should be in executed in various schools are not being executed consistently. And even in the good locations, there's still gaps. So I recently spoke to a GSA in Halifax, who have been doing some really good work for quite a lot of years, and they talk about how the support for their 2SLGBTQ plus youth and the GSA aren't just that one-off thing. They're things that are integrated in a lot of places in the educational curriculum and around the school. But they also talk about how some of the things that they do, they can't do at the school because they're too expensive. So for instance, gender neutral washrooms, they're few and far between. They're often in places that are used for other activities that aren't necessarily good. And the very fact that they tend to be on the fringes of the school set up these situations for not being watched, and therefore bullying that happens when those youth students are looking to use those facilities. But also because they tend to be on the edges of the school, they create difficulties for students in terms of the amount of time it takes. So time out between lessons, for instance, makes it very obvious when they are entering into classrooms late. And I was told that whilst requests have been put in to modify the facilities, the pushback has been that the cost is too high. And I was told in one place that that was circa around $100,000 for fix-up work because of the age of the school. Personally, I don't think you can pitch $100,000 against the risk of suicide.
Mm-hmm. Although there's been a ban on conversion therapy, how is it still unintentionally happening?
Yeah, this is a complex subject and one that I'm particularly strong advocating for. So I got involved in the eventual generation of the conversion therapy ban C4, but I was involved earlier than that because of all pieces of the proposed legislation that weren't litigable. Even with a full blanket ban, you can't. There's a couple of issues. One, to bring a case to a court, you have to be able to show evidence. And because of the insidious way that conversion therapy usually happens, you're not going to have the evidence that's usually going to be required for a court of law, particularly if you've got a minor involved. Their word is not necessarily going to carry weight against a whole pile of other people involved. The other part to this, or one of the other parts to this, is those kind of conversion therapies that are happening are going to start happening behind closed doors. they're going to happen often in a religious background. And the churches that do that kind of thing are kind of walking, treading carefully along a thin line to try and keep doing it without telling the world what they're doing. And that came up in some of the news coverage last year from the Summerside Community Church that hit the, at least I think it hit CBC and one other news outlet, where somebody did walk away from that church because of what they were talking about. So these two pieces mean that even though the conversion therapy ban is out there, it's still going to happen. And it's going to happen with children in family environments who will put their religious freedoms ahead of the safety of the child. And in a lot of cases, that has led to suicides again. When I was working to get that legislation in place, a number of people reached out to me locally who had had family members who experienced conversion therapy and taken their lives, and the family didn't want to talk about it or reach be public about it because there's still a lot of shame around it. So with those kind of veils drawn around the entire subject, trying to get something through the courts to test that law, that first case that becomes the test case, is going to be very, very difficult.
What other ways can like community members help push this issue to the forefront?
So community members that want to be allies to SLGBT people, students, youth, children, can speak up. They can write letters in support of this open letter from the Nova Scotia College of Social Workers to their local MLAs, to the Minister of Education, and they can educate themselves. So another part of the kind of work that I do is the equity, diversity, and inclusion training to bring about that, those pieces of education. There's a lot of misconception about things like transgender and non-binary being a new fad when the history of gender differences goes back thousands of years. It's the binary that is relatively new. There's evidence in ancient Hebrew, there's evidence in ancient Egypt, there's evidence in Asia, there's evidence in our two nations communities that go back thousands of years that have terms and descriptions for transgender and non-binary and intersex conditions that show that this is not a fad and it's not new. Whereas a lot of the pushback is coming from those that are saying that the gender binary is being flouted, if you like, that the transgender and non-binary is this fad, but it's not that way at all, and it's not like it doesn't happen in other sections of nature too. That's been fairly well documented. So this kind of steadfast adherence to the binary is causing an awful lot of problems. And that happens medically too. The idea that sex is binary is completely outdated and wrong. And again, that goes back thousands of years. But the gatekeeping that's happened in society for the last however long, 1,000 years or so, has really pushed this idea that anything other than the binary is somewhat wrong in, and it's pitched that way, often with the colonial religious background of being sinful, which is blatantly not right, and it's causing an awful lot of issues and always has done.